You're listening to the Slavic Literature Pod, your shelf help guide to all things Slavic. I'm Cameron Lalana.
And I'm Matt Garrisonovich.
And today we're covering part two, chapter 48 of Vasily Grossman's Life and Fate, finishing out this section of the story of Sophia Leventon and David's story as they are killed, along with many dozens of other people, thousands more before the day will be over, in the gas chambers. And Grossman does not let us pull our eyes away, keeping the viewer's gaze on not only Sophia and not only David, but on most the people on that chamber until they are physically unable to be recognized from one another, both in person for them and us as readers. And this is a harrowing chapter, to say it lightly, and so lightly that it borders on the glib, I would even say. Is there anywhere that you'd like to start talking about this?
Yeah, I mean, on the first page, there is a little section, a part of the paragraph about the movements of the people specifically. And the following chapter, which we'll get into a lot of discussion on what it means to be free, that Grossman has a lot of feelings on freedom and what that means. But there is a very clear and literal sort of freedom that is restricted. And it is the freedom to just move in a space. And the narrator describes that this wasn't how people moved. It wasn't even how the lowest form of animal life moved. It was a movement without sense or purpose, with no trace of a living will behind it. And it's a very sad and terrifying way to describe this. And there is obviously this, you know, comparison to animals. Us humans should be above that. I think anytime when we're being described, a movement especially is being described to livestock or animals, that's not a good situation to be in, to put it lightly.
Yeah, right. And also too, I think in this sort of movement, in this, right, like it erases the self, right? It erases, for us, when we were physically seeing this, if you were to look in, you lose the ability to tell one person from the other. But more than that, as we experience with Sophia's perception as she loses David, that she loses any sense of, you know, herself, even, right? This is David's perception, excuse me, where when he's separated from Sophia Leventon, he thinks nothing existed except the present moment. Beside him, mouths were breathing, bodies were touching each other, people's thoughts and feelings fusing together. And as we will learn, as when we join Sophia Leventon's perspective again, you know, this is like the physical embodiment of her future, of her day of future, David's future, of everyone's future being erased in it. And the way that the machinery of this moment has in many ways, before even they're dead, kind of erases something more fundamental about their humanity. Like they don't even have this moment to, they're in like the most reflexive state of survival possible, which it kind of takes down humanity to its most sort of base elements.
Yeah. And then kind of moving on as we continue this terrible journey through this, there is when they re-find themselves next to each other after they've been briefly separated by the massive influx of people that are pushed into the chambers, there is this moment where Sophia is clasping David, as the narrator describes, and it's described as a peculiar strength familiar to the Germans who worked there. When they emptied the chamber, they never attempted to separate bodies locked in a close embrace. And this was such an interesting line to me, because it's such a terrifying and sad thing to picture, of course. But it's not... Grossman does an interesting thing here, where it's not described quite from Sophia or David's perspective, of course. It's then flipped and described from the people who have to remove the dead bodies, and move them to the crematorium to be burned. And so this was just like an almost like in a very strange, perverse fact of life. Like it almost takes on this air of an everyday thing. Just, yeah, well, you don't move the bodies that are clasped like that. And just the way that it's positioned in the chapter, it's very jarring, I think. And I think that's the point. The something that would seem very normal, very standard practice to somebody who is doing this is, of course, supposed to seem horrifying to us.
Yeah, right. And I do think that that moment does re again in this like the most inhuman possible moment does again return, as Grossman is wanting to do, return the humanity of these people, that in even in this kind of most reduced state, you still have people who, you know, at their core, what they do is they pull their family together, which is what Sophia Levantine does to David. She pulls him in, and you know, in that moment they become family, right? As he dies in her arms, she thinks, I've become a mother. Sort of an inverse to the place, the thematic place mother has played, plays at the end of Stalingrad, where becoming a mother is sort of a tiredly, but you know, sort of very tiredly optimistic view of the future, whereas this is the exact opposite. This is becoming a motherhood in a place where there is no more future. And I think when I was reading this, I couldn't help but think of the Sistine Madonna, which I cover a little bit in today's post, not least of all because the Sistine Madonna makes repeatedly compared talks about the Sistine Madonna being a woman carrying a child into a gas chamber. So that one is some parallels are kind of drawing themselves here. But I think in like there's this very curious kind of last moment, right, where she thinks, you know, I've become a mother, and then at the very end, there's kind of a thought that even after life goes out of her, there's still kind of feeling in her heart, a feeling of pity for everyone, for those of you alive and dead. And so there's still something that like maintains, and that's kind of what that eternal, even though an individual is lost and is lost forever, there is still something kind of eternal in this dynamic, and the dynamic of how Grossman will in the Sistine Madonna call kind of this of the Madonna and Babe, who it represents all suffering. Many, many hundreds of thousands of people have kind of adopted what he describes as mother and babe, and that also it kind of represents everyone. Those are people who've been in every situation, and that is like this is some sort of essential tie among humanity, regardless of where people come from. Everyone suffers, as we go over a couple chapters ago, that life is made of, you know, the good and the grief all at the same time, and in having this sort of this same archetype exist everywhere in an all ages, there's that is kind of like a symbol of the basest part of humanity, which is kind of freedom, human freedom, which we'll, you know, as you said, we'll talk more about tomorrow. And that's why it is often these characters are characters of suffering, because if they the Madonna and Babe has in a sense a lesser meaning in a situation where because they're representing this base humanity is not threatened in better situations. So they just don't have as much relevance as they do in times of this age of other terrible times and other terrible places, where they care on the light of what humanity has left, which is just its own humanness, its own freedom. And Grossman and the Sistine Madonna will of course say the only thing to say about our own era is that we maintained what is, you know, human in man, nothing else.
Yeah, it's definitely a switch from Stalingrad, like you said, for sure. From a time where you're optimistic about the future to a time where difficult to reconcile with what the future will bring, or you know, how you continue to move forward in the face of unimaginable devastation. Or unfortunately, I guess for Grossman and for a lot of the people living through this time, a really it doesn't have to be imagined because it was witnessed, and that's difficult to then have sort of any sort of optimism for the future.
Yeah, for sure, and that's something that I think is reflected in. I'm sure some of our readers definitely in with Dominique, who today in Discord posted, finishing another chapter where I'm watching people be murdered and struck by the thought that there's a war going on somewhere at the same time, but it's already too late to save them. By the time the gas chambers were being thought up, it was already too late for so many people. And then I think about all the chapters where thousands were lying dead or were facing death in order to try and defeat the German fascists. I have to hold the fact that it's already too late with the fact that thousands slash millions more will die fighting the war. It's just a lot of death to hold.
That was a really interesting comment because a lot of times when you read war novels, the horror of it is the war itself. And the war is still pretty rough in a lot of the scenes, but I don't think that it really depicts the true depravity and absolute evil that an individual can commit in the same way that these scenes do. And that to me is what it makes this book just, it's just different. It's just not completely a war novel, right? And it is hard to keep that in mind. And it is pretty difficult, I think, in a lot of ways to top a war novel, usually when it comes to violence and horror and disgust. And I would say that any number, I mean, just pick the last like four chapters and combine them together. I think that they are, you know, any negative adjective you come up with, they are that compared to the war scenes. I would rather read more war scenes than those last few chapters that we read again.
Right. Yeah. And kind of
given the chance.
Right. Yeah. Kind of like how in War and Peace, the war serves to make the society scenes a little bit more ridiculous. They serve a similar function here, but also perhaps, as you say, serve to make these moments all the more horrible in comparison to. I also think that that's, we've kind of made this point before, so I won't linger on it, but the evil that an individual can do is also reinforced in this chapter when David looks up and, you know, in the moments before death, sees Rosa, the private, the German soldier, staring in at them. And he wants to turn up to ask Levantin about this man's wolfish eyes. And I think it's, again, a reminder that sort of a pushback against an idea that this evil can be done dispassionately, because Rosa, by all accounts, is a very friendly, very gentle person. He doesn't rape the prisoners like Zuchenko. He's not an unpleasant person. He seems nice to his family. But that doesn't counter anything around what he's actually doing here. And when he looks in those chambers to see those dozens of people dying, he has the eyes of a wolf, and he is a wolf in this wolfish era. He's not a sort of victim of this system. He is an active participant and agent of it.
Yeah, there is no way getting around that, for sure.
Yeah. But I think that's about all I had to talk about with this one. I don't know if there's any more that you wanted to say.
No, I mean, there's always a lot more to say.
Yeah, right.
When it comes to the Grossman. But I think that's an okay spot to leave it. And if you want to hear more, of course, we have our long episode that ends on this chapter. Or around this chapter.
I think it ends like three chapters from now, but functionally, yeah, around this time.
Functionally, yeah, pretty close.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, in that case, you will hear from us again soon.